see winds blowing. I still see her dark eyes glowing. She was 21 when I left Galveston. Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea waves crashing while I watch the cannons flashing. I clean my gun and dream of Galveston. I still see her standing by the water, looking out to sea. And is she waiting there for me on the beach where we used to run? Galveston, oh Galveston, I am so afraid of dying before I dry the tears she's crying, before I watch your seabirds flying in the sun. At Galveston, at Galveston.
And welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can listen to this program and previous programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, or notices of new programs, you can friend me at Facebook. Today's program includes Inside Job. I saw the movie Inside Job, and I highly recommend it. It was directed by Charles Ferguson. He also produced No End in Sight, a documentary of the Iraq War. He was interviewed by Adam Leshefsky, who is a senior editor at Fortune magazine. They asked if the economic global meltdown of the last few years could have been prevented. His documentary, Inside Job, makes a powerful case that an out-of-control finance industry took advantage of the deregulated atmosphere and purposefully sought to get rich at the expense of others. And then after that, Policing America's Empire. Al McCoy, a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of the most recently award-winning book, Policing the American Empire, United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, talks about how empires are maintained and why the U.S. empire is in decline and what the consequences might be depending on how we respond to that decline.
Last thread before we change gears, my favorite part of your film was the interviews you did with Glenn Hubbard and Fred Mishkin, both academics who have served stints in government and made a lot of money, consulting to various entities.
A lot of money.
Yeah. Describe that a little bit, if you would.
Well, this actually, for me personally, is one of the most disturbing aspects of what has occurred. It's something that I saw beginning to happen when I was a graduate student at MIT in the late 1980s. The Law and Economics Consulting Group, for example, a consulting firm founded in Berkeley by a group of UC Berkeley professors, was founded in 1988. It is now a $350 million a year publicly traded firm. So this is big business. And what's happened is that industries with very heavy regulatory and government policy problems and involvements, and whose profitability is heavily dependent on the degree to which they're regulated, have invaded the academic economics discipline, both in economics departments and in business schools, and also public policy schools, by the way. And and have basically blanketed these institutions and people with money to a really stunning extent. And in the case of people like Hubbard and Mishkin and many others, Larry Summers, their private income from giving regulatory advice, testifying in Congress, they're paid to testify in Congress on behalf of these industries. Many people don't understand that when an academic is testifying in Congress, most of the time they're being paid to do so by somebody. That kind of income typically is 5 to 25 times the size of their academic income. These people make millions of dollars a year doing this. And it's become a very, very disturbing problem.
But I think you have to go further. The size of it alone is sort of irrelevant, isn't it? Just because it's a lot of money, okay, so what?
Well, okay, so obviously the question is, has this in fact corrupted the academic enterprise and the way these people behave when they're in government and so on? The answer is yes. And the part of the film that deals with that, you know, is very upfront about that.
Could you briefly tell the story about the Icelandic Chamber of Commerce, please?
By all means, yes. So Iceland had an extraordinary bubble, highly criminal. One of the people that we interviewed for the film, former Prime Minister of Iceland, was recently indicted. Which caused a gigantic bubble. There was an enormous financial bubble. And it began to falter around 2006. And the Icelandic banks took many steps to keep propping it up. And one thing that they did was they had the Icelandic Chamber of Commerce commission reports from prominent American and European academics saying everything's wonderful. And one of the first ones they commissioned was from Frederick Mishkin, who had just left the Federal Reserve. He had been one of the seven governors of the Federal Reserve. Excuse me, it was just before he went into the Fed. I'm sorry. He was a governor of the Fed from 2006 to 2008. And a few months before he entered the Fed, he was paid $125,000 by the Icelandic Chamber of Commerce to write this just hysterical, hallucinatory report about how Iceland's new financial system was wonderful and how Iceland was well-regulated and so forth. And he had good company, you know, and a number of other very prominent economics professors did similar things as late 2007.
And the title of his report was, can you just, it's too good to not share with the few people in the room who may not have seen your film.
The title of his report was Financial Stability in Iceland. And he falsified his resume after the crash, and the title of the report on his resume was changed to Financial Instability in Iceland. And we ask him about this, I ask him about this in the film, and he's a little embarrassed, and he says it was a typo.
That's some typo. I want to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is documentary filmmaker and Academy Award winner Charles Ferguson, who is talking about his latest film, Inside Job. I'm going to begin reading some of the questions that have been submitted. The first one is a question that is asked twice. First from the internet, which is, what is your list of the top five bankers who should be in jail? And a slightly different take on this question is, how is it that we've had 2 years of a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, and not one major figure on Wall Street has been indicted? Does Wall Street own our government?
Wall Street has come dangerously close to owning our government, unfortunately, this is now a thoroughly bipartisan problem. This is not something where Democrats and Republicans have a vast divide. So the reason, unfortunately, I have to say the Obama administration has not done anything about this is, first of all, the president has clearly made personally, individually, a decision that he doesn't want to go after this for reasons that might be personal, emotional, or might have to do with his political calculations. But more broadly, Congress and the people who go into the government, they are very heavily influenced by the size of financial industry campaign contributions, by the size of their lobbying effort, by the fact that they want to get highly paid jobs when they leave government, etc. As to, you know, my top five names, there I'm going to decline for a serious reason, which is that we haven't yet adjudicated any of this, and accusing an individual of a criminal offense is not something that one does casually. But I will say, and I mean this quite seriously, that from what I've seen, I think that a significant fraction of the senior management of American investment banking should be tried for criminal offenses.
I respect your lack of interest in putting a name out for a variety of reasons, I assume. So let's just say one of these people you're referring to. What is an example of a crime that they committed?
Oh, that is all too easy, and you know I'm happy to answer it at far greater length than you would like me to. A short sampling. Okay, so we know that Lehman Brothers engaged in accounting tricks to hide the size of its liabilities. We also know that it overvalued its commercial real estate investments by many billions of dollars for a considerable period of time, and that internally people were warning about this inside Lehman Brothers in an extremely aggressive way. Nobody has been tried for accounting fraud. We know that Merrill Lynch and other investment banks engaged in self-dealing in order to artificially prop up the value of securities that they could no longer sell on the open market. In fact, we know that Merrill Lynch traders actually paid each other bribes to have other divisions of Merrill Lynch purchase these securities, in quotes, internally to set a price and keep these securities supposedly of high value, so that Merrill would not have to write them down, also so that individual traders would be able to get bonuses.
But do we know that the CEO of Merrill Lynch or the CEO of Lehman Brothers was aware of this accounting fraud in the one case or the self-dealing in the other case?
In the case, we don't yet know as much as we should, is the way that I would put it. It seems, in both cases, almost inescapable that the top management of the firm knew at least something about this. But what we should have, of course, is we should have lots of prosecutors going through everybody's email, and we should have lower-level people getting prosecuted and flipped and made to talk, and we don't have any of that.
The Justice Department did make a run at Angelo Mozzillo, the former CEO of Countrywide. Do you have any insight into why that prosecution went nowhere and they've subsequently dropped it, right?
They have dropped it.
Officially dropped it.
Yes, they have, and I don't know why. They've also decided not to pursue any prosecution against Joseph Cassano of AIG, another major episode of this kind. He and his group made a total of over $4 billion in cash bonuses, writing several hundred billion dollars in credit default swaps very shortly before their value collapsed, causing the collapse of AIG. Cassano publicly stated that he didn't think that there would be even a single dollar of loss on any of the securities involved. And he also is known to have blocked efforts to audit his unit. That's a publicly known, verified fact.
Do you know if, this is another question from the audience, do you know if President Obama has seen Inside Job, and has he or any members of his administration talked to you about it?
The answer is no to both. I don't know whether he or other senior members of the administration have seen the film. I do know that they are very aware of the film. I know that. That's not a guess. But none of them have spoken with me directly. In fact, one of the greatest personal disappointments I had in the course of the film's distribution, and also actually it started when I was making the film, was that nobody in the Obama administration would speak with me even off the record. And these are people, in some cases, I've known for 20 years who've been my dinner guests, you know, who I regarded mm-hmm. as friends. Mm-hmm. The Bush administration was a model of openness and transparency compared to the Obama administration, at least with regard to these issues, which is, you know, that's a statement.
You singled out in the film Timothy Geithner, who was a guest of the club several months ago. Is it you know, ipso facto true that because he was the Fed governor of New York during the crisis, that he can't be an effective Treasury secretary now?
Well, I wouldn't say ipso facto, but we know at least something. You know, again, we don't know nearly as much as we should, and there's been an enormous amount of secrecy with regard to what the New York Fed did during this period, what Mr. Geithner did during this period. But we do know that he participated directly in the negotiations about how to rescue AIG, and somehow nobody paid too much attention to the possibility of forcing the investment banks to take substantial haircuts on their credit default swaps. But in that 48, 72-hour crisis period, somehow the Federal Reserve Bank of New York was able to think carefully enough to require that AIG surrender its right to sue for fraud in return for getting bailed out. Well, you know, I don't think that somebody who was involved in doing that really should be our Treasury Secretary right now.
All right. Here's the this is the call to action question from the audience. I'll just read it verbatim. He says nothing has really been done, but the movie has no call to action for the informed American. What can someone do to bring better regulation and compensation limits?
Well, I would give two answers to this, which you're probably going to find very unsatisfactory. And one of them is a kind of evasion, and the other is not, but it's still unhappy and unsatisfactory. The evasive one is, I don't really view that as my function. Why do I say that? I view myself as, you know, an investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker and filmmaker, and perhaps a policy analyst. But I am actually not really a political person. I've never held government office. I've never run for office. I never will. I did donate to the Obama campaign, but it's unusual for me even to do that. I view myself as somebody who, by what I do, hopefully informs the public so that people can take action in the ways that our democracy permits. The second answer is, unfortunately, this is a really tough problem because it is a thoroughly bipartisan problem, and we have a two-party system. And as a friend of mine remarked to me recently, if there's anything the two parties can agree on, it's the undesirability of a third major party. And we really have, you know, a kind of political cartel now as a result of the role of financial industry and sometimes other industries, the role of their money and lobbying in our political system. And I think that changing that is going to be a long, hard, difficult, gradual thing.
I'm going to take your cue on the subject of filmmaking and segue to a couple questions from the audience about the craft. There's three here. First, why did you choose to tell the story of Inside Job as a documentary film rather than, say, a magazine essay or a book? Secondly, please talk about the editing process in the making of this film. And the third question is, what is your next documentary? And I'll supplement that by asking you, what is your next project? If you need me to remind you of any of that, tell me, Charles.
I'll try. Why a film, not a book? Actually,
or a magazine essay.
Actually, I'm now writing a book based on the material we gathered in the film, and which will expand on it, and which will be published by Random House next year. I'm writing it with Charles Morris, who's one of the people who appears in the film. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I now regard myself as a filmmaker, and I have to say, you know, from a purely personal point of view, I've had several careers doing several different things, and nothing comes remotely close to making movies. Making movies is the most amazing thing in the whole world. It engages your visual sense, your sense of music and sound, of pacing. It's linear, it's nonlinear, it's intellectual, it's visceral. It's just, it's an extraordinary experience to make a movie. And so as long as the world lets me, I'm going to continue making movies because I love it. How is the film edited? For documentaries, at least, editing is the most amazing and most interesting part of filmmaking, although I enjoyed everything about making this film. But there were two editors, Chad Beck and Adam Bolt. They're brilliant people. When it came time to edit the film, I wrote a document, a very kind of, you know, former policy wonk, very highly structured document. You know, this is what I think the film should look like. they produced a 5.5 hour long assembly of what they thought was the best footage. They'd watched all the footage, and this is hundreds of hours. And they produced this assembly of what they thought was the most interesting footage. And then we started constructing individual sequences about individual issues, and then we started experimenting with how they related to each other and how they wove into each other and what their order should be. And then we wrote narration around that. It was a great, great thing. And also, the credit sequence of the film is basically a 4.5 minute long rock video. We were able to license Peter Gabriel's big time, although I will say that doing business with Peter Gabriel was not the most enjoyable part of making this movie.
Why?
You know, I would have to get very indelicate.
We're all friends here.
No. But it was arduous and unpleasant. That's a widely shared experience, it turns out. It turns out that licensing music is known to be a nightmare in movie making, and boy, was it. But we got it, and I have to say, making that 4.5 minute long music video was a lot of fun. I mean, it was a blast.
It was worth putting up with him then.
It was. And the music is great. He's a musical genius, I think, and I think the music is fabulous. So, you know, editing the film, boy, you know, peak experience, really extraordinary peak experience. As to what I'm going to do next, I don't know yet. I may make some shameless entertainment. You know, I after making 2 political disaster movies, you know, I think that I might be entitled to a break. And I love film noir. I love, you know, movies like Chinatown and L.A. Confidential and Blade Runner, you know. And if I could make one of those, I'd be in heaven.
When we were talking earlier, you used the expression classy trash.
Yes.
I love that. Tomorrow, Phil Angelides will be speaking here. What question would you like to ask him? Did you learn anything new from his report?
I haven't yet read the full text of the report. I've read only a relatively short summary of it. I'm just starting to read the whole thing now. I've spoken to several people who have read the whole thing, and I'd ask him to address 2 things. One is why they didn't use their subpoena power much more than they did. Mm-hmm. It took them several months before they even issued their first subpoena. Part of that was because they weren't given a very large budget, and you know they were very constrained by the legislation that set up the commission. But you know, one thing is, you know, why didn't they aggressively use their subpoena power? And the second thing is, why doesn't he think people should be indicted, prosecuted, and put in jail?
Does he think that people should not be? I mean, is that the conclusion?
He has thus far not been willing to address that subject in a very explicit and direct manner, and the report apparently does not. The summary that I read certainly doesn't, and the report doesn't in the reports that I've received from people who've read it.
Miracles appear in the strangest of places. Fancy meeting you here. The last time I saw you was just out of Houston. Sit down, let me buy you a beer. Your presence is welcome with me and my friend here. This is a hangout of mine. We come here quite often and listen to music, partaking of yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine, I'm yesterday's wine. Aging with time, like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine, we're yesterday's wine. Aging with time, like yesterday's wine. You give the appearance of one widely traveled,
I'll bet you've seen things in your time. So sit down beside me and tell me your story. If you think you'll like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine, well, yesterday's wine. Aging with time, like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine, well, yesterday's wine. Aging with time, like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine, well, yesterday's wine. Aging with time, like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine, well, yesterday's wine. We're aging with time, like yesterday's wine.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.